From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the March 2017 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Enter Japan. This month, we tell the story of how the code-breaking operation nestled in the Buckinghamshire countryside grew exponentially once Japan entered World War II. People who'd been diligently digging away at coded messages in German and Italian had to turn their hand to a whole new language and were sent on a startlingly short Japanese language course in nearby Bedford. They had to hope it would be enough. We'll hear from two women who worked on Japanese codes, doing very different jobs. One learned the language while the other had to use her mastery of English to disguise the source of the stolen messages. They'd never met until they were interviewed together for a Japanese newspaper. But first, the next new exhibition to open, titled Off Duty, High Spirits in Low Times, will explore what happened outside of the gruelling shifts the thousands of workers did day and night. Wartime work at the Government Code and Cipher School was stressful and tiring, but the authorities understood it was important to keep staff happy and healthy. I had a wander through the exhibition space with the exhibition's manager, Erica Munro. We're in one of the grander rooms at Bletchley Park, in the iconic Victorian mansion, as we like to call it. This is a wood-panelled, parquet-floored room with a grand ceiling in gold and white sort of roses and coving and beams. It's very fancy. Erica, what happened in here during World War II?
This room, beautiful as it is, was used for a variety of purposes during the war and quite different ones as well. So from the start of the war, teleprinter machines were based in here, noisy racket of a sound where communications were coming into the park.
As you can hear, this is actually quite an echo room. If I tap my foot, it sort of booms out. It's like, can you imagine noisy machines in here?
Absolutely. And a number of them as well, with the people coming in and out too. Chitter. It must have been constant. As the park got bigger and expanded and temporary huts were built and then the more permanent blocks were built, the machines were moved out of this space. And it was realised that this space is actually, it's a ballroom. It's a beautiful space to use for more suitable activities. So the recreational club moved into here and used it as a space for activities and events such as Scottish country dancing and for holding more social events. And nearer the end of the war, it became a place for quiet reading, almost a sort of reading room and library type space.
So that list of all these different things this room was used for during the war kind of gives you a sense of some of the material you're going to be mining for this exhibition, some of the stories that you're going to be telling about what people got up to when they went on shift.
Absolutely. We had a huge amount of material that we could have used. Archival material, research material, oral history, memories, letters and so on. And from that, we decided that the stories that we could tell were more about what Bletchley Park could arrange for the staff. So whilst we had wonderful stories about people falling in love or people cycling in the countryside, we were particularly interested in what the authorities at Bletchley Park were able to put into place in order to support their staff. They realised that the hard work, the really difficult conditions here at Bletchley Park could cause staff to become stressed, depressed, and that work would then suffer. So it was decided that recreation and free time activities should be supported.
When we hear anecdotes about Bletchley Park, we often hear about the off-duty time because I think it looms larger in their minds, partly because they were young, probably away from home for the first time in most cases, but also because that was the majority of what they could talk about to other people and to each other, because they weren't allowed to talk about the work they were doing other than within their own unit. So they must have those fairly fresh in their mind, those anecdotes about what they got up to.
This exhibition is a great opportunity for us to really use the archival material, the letters that were sent that have been then given to Bletchley Park for our archive, some diaries that we've been able to use, the memoirs that have been written and sent in to us or that have been published, also the oral history interviews that have been performed and that we have the audio for and the transcripts. We've been able to use a whole variety of those in the exhibition to create these different voices that are all telling their stories about what they did. And you're absolutely right, that work that they did was such a secret part of their lives that they were then able to really communicate about their free time activities.
And they could perhaps tell their parents about that, or some of it wasn't fit for parental consumption, was it? When you hear some these stories.
Some of the stories we hear in the oral history are actually exceedingly interesting and probably would never have made it into a letter home.
You can tell these people are talking long after anyone that would be offended by it has left this earth.
We actually found that as well with some of the material we're displaying. We've had to be very careful. Some of these people who sent letters home, either the veterans themselves are still alive and with us and hopefully visiting the exhibition, or their family members are going to be coming in. So we've had to be very careful about what we've told. We want to be as thorough as we can be, but also we're very well aware that these are people's private and personal stories.
From a historical point of view, when you are looking after the story of Bletchley Park and deciding how you disseminate it and tell it to people who come and visit, it's very easy to fall into the trap, I think, of concentrating on process and kind of technological stuff, which is fascinating. And largely why we are interested in Bletchley Park is how incredible those achievements were. But this is a whole other side to it, isn't it? And this is fascinating because it gives you a slice of life at that time. And the hiatus these people were going through, you know, that how they did something completely different for 6 years or 4 years or 2 years.
Yeah, and the impact on their lives that also had. So some people were coming here very, very young, or they'd never left home before. Some people bringing their families and uprooting their whole family life from where they lived to locally here in Bletchley. So it had a dramatic effect on what they were doing.
Can you give us a taste of how it looks in your imagination? Because we're standing in a pretty empty room at the moment, but what's it going to look and sound and feel like?
The exhibition is going to be divided over two spaces, the billiard room and the ballroom. In the billiard room, we look at how difficult work was for people based here at Bletchley Park, about the stress of the working conditions and the welfare provisions that Bletchley Park was able to provide. It's an introduction which realises how the authorities were responsible for the staff here and gives us a bit of a taste as to why recreation and free time activities were so important. The recreational club and its various sporting and free time activities were funded by the authorities at Bletchley Park. Also, other activities that they did outside of their sort of core code-breaking work, things like the Defence Force, the Home Guard, very necessary free time activities, but also obligatory free time activities. So we'll be looking into a little bit of that. From the billiard room, where we look at how people perhaps struggled in their working life or the effects that the work had on them, their health and their well-being, we move into the ballroom, which really explores the free time activities provided by the recreational club. We look at some of the other areas as well where people were allowed to go on leave. Now, again, we're approaching it from the perspective of Bletchley Park and how it organised people's free time. So we look at how the shift system allowed people to take a number of days of leave and what they did. The workers here might go to London or they might go to Bedford, go to the cinema or even just spend time in their billets. We also look at where they lived. People didn't really live here at Bletchley Park. There was a hostel here, but the majority of the staff that were here didn't live on site. I think a lot of our visitors don't really, that's not made explicit in a lot of places. So we have a wonderful map which shows the extent to where those billets were located around the local area, all the way out to Buckingham, Northampton. Just really to give a sense of what free time meant. The distances people had to travel when there wasn't a lot of public transport meant that often free time was taken up through travelling or staying in their billet or their accommodation and eating or just chatting to each other. We wanted to give a thorough picture, not just to be able to say everybody at Bletchley Park was taking part in plays or in Christmas reviews, singing and dancing. We also wanted to give that balanced picture where we're able to say, through the words of our veterans and through the words of the letters and diaries that we have, that perhaps work was isolating, that free time for some people didn't mean getting together and enjoying themselves. It meant taking time out and away from work. So we're hoping that the exhibition gives a really rounded idea of what it might have been like to be here at Bletchley Park by simply the number of stories we've been able to tell. We have a lot of oral history excerpts that we've got on audio points that will be throughout the room. We've got a lot of veterans' quotes that will appear throughout on graphic panels throughout the space as well. We've been able to display a couple of diaries and some letters and some drawings and also some wonderful scripts from some of the skits that were produced for the recreational club that sort of poke fun at what life was like, about the stress, about the secrecy, and about how people felt working here.
So it's their words, largely.
Absolutely. We feel that who are we really to dictate what life was like for people at Bletchley Park during the war? with nearly 10,000 people working here, everybody's experiences are going to be different. A wren who was away from home for the first time working in one of the huts with the bomb machines would have an extremely different experience to a codebreaker who brought his family here locally, who's living nearby and perhaps not working a shift system. It's such a different experience, and in some cases quite a contradictory experience, where some people remember it as an isolated, lonely time, some people remember it as the most fun or the really jolly and fantastic and social experience, that we've wanted to be able to represent all of those perspectives. So the exhibition will really give kind of a multi-voice perspective on what we see as free time here at the park.
What's the use of jiving? You better straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow.
There's a treat in store for mums this Mother's Day with a special afternoon tea on Sunday the 26th of March. Jazz singer Alison Carter will serenade you while you enjoy sumptuous scones, sandwiches and cakes. Mums will be presented with a long stem rose and a glass of fizz. And tickets include a season pass to the park. Afternoon tea in the iconic Victorian mansion is also available on selected days throughout the year. Book your place now on the Bletchley Park website.
Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top.
From the 1st of April and throughout the Easter holidays, there are family trails and activities and an egg hunt. The most glamorous day out going is back on the 8th of April, as Sarah Dunn of Sarah's Doo-Wop Doos brings the 1940s boutique once again to Bletchley Park. Learn how to create the iconic look of the decade, including victory rolls and the signature Vavavoom red lips. It's a day-long vintage hair and beauty workshop with lunch and a tour of Bletchley Park thrown in. Book your place online now. The work of the codebreakers at Bletchley Park remains relevant in today's digital age. And there's an exhibition in the Visitor Centre dedicated to keeping safe online. The cybersecurity exhibition, which is sponsored by Intel Security, has been upgraded. It draws a direct link with the pioneering data processing, which was done in that very building during World War II, and the ever-evolving cyber threat today. The interactive displays teach visitors of all ages how to safely navigate cyberspace. This month's It Happened Here story is a truly global one. It's about what happened when the war was no longer just in Europe. In December 1941, Japan entered World War II. Japan's involvement in the conflict meant intelligence gathering and processing became a far bigger and more complex task, which brought about the need for significant expansion of the top secret operation at Bletchley Park. We'll hear from two of the women who worked on Japanese codes at Bletchley Park, who had never met until they were interviewed together for a Japanese newspaper commemorating the conflict. Podcast producer Mark Cotton was allowed privileged access to the Bletchley Park archive, where archivist Guy Revel showed him some of the tools used to help the codebreakers learn Japanese. First, I look back at this seismic change with Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. We should like to now try to call in Manila, the capital of the Philippine Commonwealth. Go ahead, Manila. This is CBS in America calling Manila. Go ahead. We regret that we are unable to contact either Honolulu or Manila. We return you now to...
Here is the news. Japan's long-threatened aggression in the Far East began tonight with air attacks on United States naval bases in the Pacific. Fresh reports are coming in every minute. The latest facts of the situation are these. Messages from Tokyo say that Japan has announced a formal declaration of war against both the United States and Britain. The Japanese air raids were made on the Hawaiian Islands and the Philippines. President Roosevelt has told the Army and Navy to act on their secret orders, has called a meeting of ministers, and is preparing a report for Congress. In London, Mr. Wynant has seen Mr. Churchill and both...
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Everybody's heard of Pearl Harbor, and we all know of it as an enormous and awful surprise for America, certainly. What can you tell us about the backstory?
Well, it's well known as an attack on the United States through their naval base in Hawaii, but it's also, the very same day, there was an attack on British possessions in the Far East as well. The Japanese launched an amphibious attack on Malaya. The attack on Malaya proved to be hugely successful for the Japanese. They conquered the whole country in very short order, and by February had attacked Singapore, which was the heart of the British Empire in the East, if you like. It was considered to be a fortress that would never be captured. And unfortunately, it was heavily defended against attack from the sea, and the Japanese basically attacked it from the land, which should and could have been foreseen, but through a variety of unfortunate incidents. Singapore fell in February 1942, and that was a huge blow to British power in the East, but also British morale worldwide. And it was certainly felt back in the UK and at Bletchley as well. Up to that point, certainly for Bletchley Park, the focus had been on North Africa and the Battle of the Atlantic. And all of a sudden, this is a whole new sphere of warfare opening up and moving very fast.
So what was the British situation in the Far East at that time, before Pearl Harbor?
Well, the British had been interested in Japanese codes and Japanese military activity in the East for many years in 1941. I mean, the Japanese had been empire building in the area from the early 30s. They invaded Manchuria and China and had been up to all sorts for a long time. Japan, in the First World War, was actually on the Allied side against the Germans. But opinion in Japan had turned after the First World War. And also, they were a very significant naval power. They had the third largest navy in the world after Britain and the United States. So they had a huge naval capability, which obviously had to be kept an eye on. And so the British had been reading Japanese codes with varying degrees of success since the late 1920s. And people like John Tiltman had been working on Japanese codes. And a chap called Nobby Clark, who had been in Room 40 in the First World War, breaking codes, and he went on to be heavily involved with Japanese codes in the interwar period. So work was already going on trying to keep tabs on what the Japanese were up to.
And was that happening here at Bletchley Park up to 1941?
Some of it was happening at Bletchley Park. A lot of it was happening in the Far East itself. An organisation called the Far East Combined Bureau that was set up in Hong Kong in 1934. And we've also spoken previously in these podcasts about the Combined Bureau Middle East, which was the Cairo branch of the operation. There was an equivalent office in Hong Kong, and it was positioned there because Hong Kong's a great place to listen to Japanese communications. The day that GC&CS moved from London to Bletchley Park was also the day that Far East Combined Bureau moved out of Hong Kong because they thought it was vulnerable to the Japanese and moved to Singapore. And so they were based in Singapore during the invasion of Malaya and Pearl Harbor and everything else. Unfortunately, Singapore fell in February, so they had to move again, and they moved to Colombo in modern Sri Lanka in February, and indeed moved again after that to East Africa, so they were a fairly peripatetic outfit. They had a program initially that was led by the Admiralty, where they had specially trained radio operators on certain ships in the fleet who were intended to spend not quite their spare time, but a good portion of their time listening to Japanese communications. And the problem you have is that the Japanese use a different form of Morse code from everybody else. And so your radio operators have to be specially trained.
That takes time, of course.
It takes a lot of time. And while taking down the messages requires you to learn a different form of Morse code, actually breaking the codes requires a knowledge of the Japanese language and the various scripts that Japanese can be written in, and it's a hugely complicated task.
With the coming of the war against Japan, it became obvious that the British would need more ability to read Japanese communications. Although we had been reading Japanese language communications from the 20s onwards, the number of people available to do that was quite small. With the war, the number of communications being sent was going to ramp up massively, and so the workload in intercepting, deciphering and reading them was going to ramp up massively. There was only one course at the School of Oriental African Studies, and that took up to 5 years, and obviously that wasn't going to be sufficient for the needs of the British. So a gentleman called John Tiltman, who was working for Bletchley Park, decided that we needed a much shorter course. He had been investigating Japanese codes himself, and he claimed to have taught himself sufficient Japanese to break a code within 6 months. He took this to the School of Oriental African Studies, and they said that they could probably do a shorter course, but it would be at least 2 years to provide a suitable standard. Obviously, that's four times as long as Tiltman had taken. They were a little bit disbelieving, so he had to set up his own course, and that led to the course at the Inter-Service Special Intelligence School at Bedford. The Inter-Service Special Intelligence School at Bedford already existed and was teaching courses in Arabic and other languages.
Oh, right.
So as an administrative shortcut, they essentially plonked this Japanese course into their remit. And in order to teach it, obviously you need an instructor. And Tiltman chose Captain Oswald Tuck, who was a retired Royal Navy captain. I believe Tuck had taught himself Japanese and had been translating Japanese works for the Admiralty and had retired from that in 1937. Somehow, Tiltman got a hold of him and brought him back and asked him if he would try and teach this course in 6 months. And Tuck was energised by the idea and loved it and took it on. Tiltman is one of the geniuses of the Government Code and Cipher School. He worked on codes and ciphers, both in the field and strategic level. He broke meteorological codes that were being used by the Germans for the French, went on to have a big hand in the initial breaking of the Lorentz cipher.
Yeah, of course.
So he really is up there with Turing.
So we know that Bletchley Park went trawling around their home counties, taking over stately homes. Did they do the same in Bedford?
No, in fact, what they ended up with initially was the county gas showroom. They were in the demonstration room above the public access showroom on the Broadway in Bedford, opposite the John Bunyan statue. And one of the problems with this was that it was right next to a main thoroughfare. And there was a lot of traffic noise, including convoys of tanks driving past as the students were trying to learn Japanese. And bearing in mind that Japanese is a very difficult language to understand, it has many forms, there's several alphabets, and the usage is defined by the situation which you find yourself in. So journalistic Japanese is very different from diplomatic Japanese, not just in the structure, but also in the words that you would use for the same thing. So it's quite complicated, and these are people that have never seen Japanese before. They're trying to learn all these things and the calligraphy that goes with it, because Japanese is an ideographic language, while convoys of tanks are going past. And it has been said that that is the reason that every day the front row moved to the back and everyone shuffled to the front so they could get here better. An alternative view is that just allowed people to be nearer the front and be interrogated by Tuck and his subsequent assistants. They stayed there for a little bit, but then the gas company wanted their building back, so they had to move to 7 St Andrews Road, which was a detached house with lots of little rooms, but they didn't have a lecture space. Now, that didn't matter, because at the point of the move, which was halfway through the first course, the people on the course already had sufficient knowledge and they were just able to work in groups in the different rooms, and Tuck would meander around the house giving help as and when needed. For the second course, they were also at St Andrews Road, but they needed a space to be taught in, and they had to go to the Victory Hall, which was essentially a music hall that wasn't being used because of the time of year. So they were being taught in this large cavernous space that just happened to be available. Later on again, the school moved to a house in De Paris Avenue in Bedford, and that's where it remained. So it lived a peripatetic existence, travelling round Bedford as and when new spaces were required for various reasons.
It again speaks to how Bletchley Park was set up. You know, it was this collection of huts that were suddenly
Indeed. Up. And it wasn't just the buildings either. They had no teaching materials. The first course arrived and all they had were a couple of dictionaries and a grammar that were brought by Tuck, and they had to share all of these resources. They ended up practicing on late 1941 journalistic cables, which had been sent by Japanese newspapers to Japan from London.
Yeah.
And following the declaration of war, Japanese newspapers had left, essentially. Mm. And the Press Censorship Bureau, which had been holding on to these copies after having passed them as suitable for publication, passed them on to the school in Bedford. They also didn't have any paper for the first course. They had essentially photomechanical reproduction paper,
yeah,
which was greasy and black on one side, and they improvised by writing on the reverse of it. So very much ad hoc, scrabbling around, getting whatever they can, putting it together to make this course, which, although it was intended to run for 6 months, was so successful, despite having to move around Bedford, contend with the traffic noise, no resources. Despite all of that, the course ended up only lasting 5 and a bit months because they had been taught all that they needed to know in order to undertake the tasks that were envisioned for them.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Tiltman, because he'd come from the background of the work he'd been doing, he knew, I imagine, that you do only need this slice of Japanese, really, because it's military Japanese. It's going to be certain things reoccurring over and over, isn't it?
That's correct. For example, personal pronouns are quite rarely used in Japanese. So whilst the people who are on the course would know the word for submarine or division or reconnaissance, they wouldn't know I, as in I am this, yeah, I am the other. It just wasn't going to appear in the type of communication that the Japanese were going to be sending. One of the texts that they did have was the, if you can excuse the pronunciation, which I'm sure is incorrect, the Kenkyusha Japanese English Dictionary, and that had a word and then illustrated the word with a sentence. Now, this could lead to some interesting definitions. So, for example, the sentence that illustrated the word supper was illustrated with the sentence, "I will meet you after supper outside the brothel." Apparently, that was suitable for inclusion in the dictionary.
It's really haphazard how this has been set up. There's no resources, but they've managed to construct this from nothing, haven't they?
It was, and it was really successful as well. At the end of the course, so after 5 and a bit months, so not even the 6 months that it was intended to run, they held a conference in London to examine the worth of the course and was it worthwhile running more.
Yeah.
And some people from the School of Oriental and African Studies were at the conference. On the fly, without any warning, gave a newspaper report to two of the students from the course to translate. Now, the students weren't expecting to be asked to do this,
no,
but they took it into a room next door with a dictionary, and they came back 15 minutes later and were reading it out loud correctly, and then they continued to read the second page on the fly without reference to dictionary. And so the School of Oriental African Studies was probably, although they were testing them, they were probably trying to show that there was no worth in the Bedford system. So it kind of backfired. Eventually, SOAS, the School of Oriental African Studies, did run courses as well, complementary to the ones at Bedford. And in fact, someone who was taught on one of the Bedford courses, so was there for 6 months, ended up being a teaching assistant on the SOAS courses.
Oh, right.
And SOAS instructors had gone to Bedford to see how it was done. And some of the methodologies employed by Bedford were a revelation. For example, students would be asked to mark certain sections of the work for the whole class. So if they were asked to write out a 4-paragraph treatise, then one student would mark the first paragraph for all of the course, another student would mark the second paragraph for all of the course, so on and so forth. And then they would go to the front of the class and they would justify their marks and be open to challenge.
Oh, really?
So there'd be a discussion around all of this marking. And when he saw that, the SOAS instructor suddenly realised that that would not only remove some of the burden of the teaching and marking from him, but it was also improving the way in which the Japanese was being learnt. So I say, revelatory. This is all necessity being the mother of invention.
Mm.
It needs to happen, and it needs to happen in this time frame. And as you said, they're only learning specific sections of Japanese.
Yeah.
by the end of the course, they are already, so before they get to the end of 5 and a bit months, they're already working on Japanese textbooks about aeronautics and all of the technical terms that you would find in aeronautics. So one of the dictionaries was found to not have 10 words that appeared in a 10-line description of Wake Island in the Pacific.
Oh, right.
So these aren't technical words, they're not esoteric words, they are just basically geographical words that could be applied to describing any of the thousands of islands in the Pacific, but they weren't in the dictionary. So that just goes to show that dictionaries, although they have a use, obviously, they're always behind the actual live use of the language.
Yeah, yeah.
So the students were again learning the Japanese without having a reference that would contain some of the words, and they had to work it out for themselves through context.
It's just mad, isn't it?
It is, rather, yes. But it worked, and they got good results. And ultimately, at Bedford, they ran 11 courses. The smallest course was the 4th, which only had 11. But the next course, the 5th, had 33 students. And the numbers fluctuated across the 11 courses. But eventually, 225 individuals were taught at the Bedford School using the Bedford methods. And then additionally, there were the SOAS courses, but they tended to be longer courses, a year or 2 years. Mm-hmm. Initially, they were for people who had intended to speak Japanese conversationally. The people taught at Bedford would not be able to hold a conversation.
No.
They would only be able to talk in the way of a formal transmission, which obviously isn't going to work conversationally.
No.
Another issue that we haven't yet touched upon is the method of transmission of Japanese, where they're broadcasting in text as opposed to numerical codes. The Japanese, because they don't have an alphabet, they don't use international standard Morse code. They have to invent what was then known as Kana Morse, Kana being one of the methods of writing in Japanese. So when it was first heard, the dits and the dots that were coming across the airwaves, they weren't making any sense because they weren't in this standard Morse code. And in addition to that, the Japanese used the Chinese telegraphic code, which is not a code in the sense of disguising something. It's transforming a word into an understandable numerical value. So it's converting pictures into numbers for transmission. Yeah. So they're using that system in addition to their Kana Morse. And Kana has two varieties, and that's only one of three writing styles. Japanese doesn't have an alphabet. The Japanese system works on Chinese characters and also then their Kana script. And Kana typically was used as a phonetic, but because it's an ideographic system, there are many words that have different pictures, but exactly the same pronunciation. The best equivalent I can give in English is paw. So a cat's paw, a paw in your skin, to pour water, or to have no money. They all pronounce the same, but if you were to see them written down, they would be spelt differently. And it's the same in Japanese. You would see a different picture, but you would pronounce it exactly the same. And so you had to learn all of these, and you would work out from the context which was the one that was meant.
And that's even before you decide what you're going to do with the traffic that you've just decoded.
That's right, yes. There's multiple stages.
So as with everything at Bletchley Park, we pretty much rely on donations, really, don't we, of artefacts. So can you explain to me what these are and where they've come from and the importance of them?
So what we have here is brown leatherette writing case, which is chock full of archive material relating to Susan Margaret Wayne, who was a Wren, served in the Women's Royal Naval Service during the Second World War at Bletchley. And part of her job at Bletchley was working with Japanese signals. So she was taught Japanese and how to interpret it. And one of the items we have is an introduction to Japanese, which is a foolscap typescript comprising 13 pages. And that's your introduction to Japanese.
Looking at this, it's just remarkable that they ever managed to break anything. But I suppose this talks to the genius of setting up this school, because they just gave them what they needed, didn't they?
Indeed, yes. Everything that you know about how to read and write English, it doesn't apply when you're talking about Japanese. The words are alien, the way they appear is alien, there's no alphabet, and the way that you construct all the sentences is completely different. Another part of the collection of material that we have is what are known as flashcards. On the one side, you have a Japanese or Chinese character. Then on the reverse, you have the name of it and its pronunciation or various pronunciations that it could have, and also English language translation. So the flashcards were key to learning Japanese. In his book Codebreaker in the Far East, Alan Stripp, who was on one of the courses at Bedford, talks about the importance of the flashcards. And he says, but the real tool for learning characters was the card. We made these ourselves, carefully drawing the characters and listing the readings, which in itself was a valuable start to learning them. Kept in cigarette boxes and carried about with us, shuffling them to make sure that none were forgotten, or picking out real brutes to study more intently. As there is no alphabet as such in Japanese, you have to learn the thousands of characters that make up the words. And to do that, you would need to see those characters and
see them regularly.
Yes, and test yourself on whether you had understood them or not.
This is priceless to us, isn't it?
It is, certainly, yes. I mean, we don't have any other copies, for example, of the introduction that I mentioned. These are the personal flashcards produced by this individual. These are really the product of the course. If we didn't have these, we wouldn't necessarily know how that Japanese was being taught, what the people were equipped with to tackle the Japanese. We have recently also acquired a collection of papers from Eric Seidel, who was on the first course at Bedford and subsequently went back to teach the following courses. And that includes some of the teaching materials. And from the dates on them, it looks like it's the original courses material that they were practicing on, dated late 1941. So obviously before the course was established in February 42.
So how much of a scramble to catch up was there back here at Bletchley Park?
Once the war began, there was a significant focus on getting geared up to deal with Japanese traffic in a much bigger way. I mean, obviously, while they remained out of the war, they weren't a priority in the way the Germans were. The work was going on, but
did it then take a different turn after Pearl Harbor, though?
It did take a different turn because the focus shifted from diplomatic intelligence, which was the main focus before, working out what Japan's intentions were, you know, what they were doing diplomatically, to actually trying to intercept their military and naval operational communications. And so a different set of codes are involved. The Japanese naval codes, both the British and the Americans had worked on them through the 1920s and 30s. And again, you get the same story as existed with Enigma and the German codes, that cooperation wasn't always what it might have been. Some of the figures in the US Navy were very reluctant to share what they knew with the British. And so the organisation wasn't as joined up as it could have been. Simply communicating with each other is very difficult. If you've got a British operation that's split between here at Bletchley and Singapore, and then it's evacuated from Singapore, the Americans have an operation that's partially based in Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, partially based in Washington, D.C., and then elements of it are moved to Brisbane in Australia. And you know, you can't just pick up the phone or email them. The communication is dodgy at best and has to be kept secret. So simply sharing intercepted traffic, for example, was a major task. There was a point where Singapore was communicating with the Philippines by, they would basically put the intercepted traffic in a bag and put it on the Pan Am Airlines flight from the one location to the other. But even with the best will and intentions, you know, the fact that everybody's scattered about over thousands of miles from one another.
And that British operation kept having to up and move because it kept being bombed, didn't
they?
Pack
up boxes and ship off.
At one time, did they get a bit of advance notice of that?
An incident that must have put the wind up everybody a bit is the Easter 1942 Japanese attack on Colombo itself. The same Japanese carrier task force that had attacked Pearl Harbor made a foray into the Indian Ocean with an intent to destroy the remains of the British Eastern Fleet. Two major ships, the Repulse and the Prince of Wales, had been sunk by Japanese bombers in December, almost at the outbreak of war. And the Japanese came through to finish the job. And the Far East Combined Bureau team in Colombo intercepted a message concerning Japanese operations, and they were able to pick out the word Colombo, or Koronbo, as it was spelt in Japanese, in the actual message. And you can imagine sitting at a desk and finding that the plan is to attack where you're sitting. kind of been very encouraging. Yes.
Going to the boss, you know, you really need to see this.
Imagine. And actually, the Bureau was forced to pack up again and move to Mombasa in Kenya. The problem with Mombasa is by that point, they were so far away from the major areas of Japanese operation that they couldn't really intercept that many messages. The thing was handicapped just by the distance and the fact that you weren't getting the radio messages. So I mean, later in the war, they did subsequently move back to Colombo again when they decided that the Japanese weren't going to actually invade Sri Lanka. But you can imagine by that point, Easter in 1942, Churchill's response to the attack on Ceylon was, he described it as the most dangerous moment of the war. And you can imagine Singapore had fallen. The Japanese were at that point running pretty rampant around the Far East and nothing was going right. And the situation in North Africa was still looking pretty dodgy. So although the Americans were finally in the war since December, they weren't doing that well either. I mean, the Americans suffered a string of defeats in the Pacific in the early part of the war.
Withstood a terrific pounding. Just made broadcast to Manila to arrange meeting for surrender. Talk made by General Beebe. I can't say much. Can't think at all.
Thank you very much. We're really grateful for your time, and we'll hear shortly from your experience.
Well, you will see in Bletchley Park in a very, very different state from when we worked here, because, of course, there was no tourist interest. And today it's full of tourists and people. And the blocks that we worked in has now been obliterated, unfortunately. So you are not seeing any part of the Japanese department at all. It's all now a housing estate, and the park is only a fraction of the size it used to be when we worked here.
That's very true. It's the block that we worked in, Block F, was, I don't know which way you came in, but it's the area, as Mary's just said, where the new houses are now. And so there's nothing to show you from that point of view, unfortunately.
Well, it was very different from the huts. Nothing like the huts.
No.
It was a concrete block, and it had a very long central corridor, which we called the Burma Road.
Yes.
And from the Burma Road, there were spurs going off on either side alternately. And it was a very long walk. And the particular apartment I worked in was at the very end of the Burma Road, and it was a long walk to get to my office.
Wow. I think mine was on the left as you go in, and it was another spur out to the left.
You had an easier walk.
I had an easier walk, yes.
But the thing was that we didn't know what was going on anywhere else in the block. I didn't even know what was going on in the office next door to me. And that was the state of security at the time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. I was in the same position. Yes. Mary and I did not know each other then.
No.
We met in January.
We met this year. In January.
Yes, yes.
Could you tell us, back then, what were you doing exactly?
Well, I went to the School of Oriental and African Studies at London University to learn Japanese. And I was with six other members of the Women's Royal Air Force. And there were only seven of us who learnt Japanese in London at the school throughout the war. Other people learnt Japanese in other places. And I was the first one to come to the park. At the time, I didn't know it, but there was a job that was urgent in the air section of the Japanese unit. There was a separate air section, and I was in the Air Force, and Betty was in the Army. So we were in different services.
Different services.
Yes.
Yes.
And I was sent down to do this particular job, and I never went back to the School of Oriental and African Studies. I stayed here until the end of the war.
So do you speak Japanese?
No,
no.
Not a word. Not a word.
I had one word, didn't I?
Yes.
Oh, I could say baku nekiki.
Baku nekiki, yes.
Yes, what I could say it.
Well, warplane, bomber.
Bomber, right.
Bomber.
I see.
Bomber.
All right.
Bomber.
Yeah.
You must remember, it was 70 years ago.
Yes, yes.
And I haven't been to Japan, and so therefore I'm afraid I don't remember the language because I've had no practice.
Yeah.
And after all, it was wartime, so we only had a wartime vocabulary.
Yeah.
I couldn't say, come and have tea this afternoon.
Yes, hammer is a special word. Yes.
We used to go down in London, we used to go on the number 14 bus with our little Kana cards, and we used to turn them over like this, and all the passengers on the bus would look. What on earth are they doing? Turning over our Kana cards.
Were you the only class learning Japanese, or were there other classes as well? Just that you were...
We were part of a large group of airmen and Navy and Army.
But did they keep you separate?
Mostly Navy and Air Force.
Mm. Right.
Just a few Army. Yeah. But we all learned together in one big sort of class.
Mm.
But just 7 WAF.
Right.
And there were no other girls. We were the only girls. All the rest were men.
Do you remember any of the other classmates? Did you ever talk, or was it all quite...
The good thing about the 7 girls was that we became very, very close friends, and we remained so until, alas, I'm the only one left. The others have all died. And so I must say that I represent the other 6 who are not here today. Otherwise, it would have been their opportunity to meet you as well as mine.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. Could you tell us about the work here? What did you do?
Well, I wasn't very certain what I was doing most of the time. Well, of course, we were an air department, and therefore we concentrated on the Japanese Air Force.
Did you ever have a sense of the significance of the role that you were doing?
To begin with, no. But gradually, of course, we realised that it was important.
And that, were there ever sort of messages that you were writing down and you thought, wow, this must be really important, or that this could be significant? Were you expected to prioritise messages in any way?
It is a very difficult question because, you see, I think it's fair to say, Mary, don't misunderstand me, but we were fairly junior, were we not?
We were.
And I was very junior, so I just did as I was told, without question.
Yes.
And so, apart from the fact that we knew that everything that went on in our particular room was important, we were not able to understand the full exercise. In my case, I was asked to paraphrase the translated messages. I never spoke Japanese, didn't understand at all. But what I handled was already translated, and it was my job to put the message into other words which meant the same thing, but would not perhaps be recognized if it was picked up by your people. They would still have a question mark. Are Bletchley breaking the code or are they not? Because I had put my own words into the message. And that's all I know. I don't know where they went to. Nobody ever told me.
You see, this was all part of the wonderful security, wasn't it?
We were. That's right.
It was all part of security.
Yes. Yeah. You see,
we didn't know the whole. We only knew a part of the whole.
You were just taking the part very small.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
That's how security was maintained.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So when, the Secrecy Act has been...
Oh, that was in July 1975.
And afterwards you... had started to speak out.
No. We didn't want to.
No. We never took the slightest notice of it. No. And we kept absolutely quiet until 1993, when we had our 50th anniversary.
That's right, yes.
It was the first time we told each other what we had done.
Well, we had reunions organised by one of our very senior signals officer, and he invited us to come and... join in and to give a little bit about each story that we had to tell. And that way we built it up over the years.
So you slowly started to understand
what
was
happening. That's right. But it was very slow, wasn't it?
It was very, very slow. Very slow. Mm.
Yeah. Okay, well, ladies, could you tell me then, you know, you worked in a very important part of the history, 70 years after the Second World War, and how do you feel?
Well, I feel that I don't ever want a war to occur ever again.
Oh, yes.
And unfortunately, it has never come true in my lifetime, because they've been going on all around the world, have they not?
Mm.
In small ways. And now we have terrorism, yes, which we didn't have before.
Mm. Well, we'll always have wars. Isn't there something in the Bible which suggests that as long as mankind is on the earth, there will always be wars of some sort. It's true, isn't it?
It is, so far.
So there we are. We can't get away from it.
If you look back in history, there's never been a long period of peace, has there?
Yeah.
No, afraid not.
Well, sadly. Mm.
Yeah.
It's so sad.
Mm.
Yeah, well, ladies, if you could kindly give some message to the Japanese readers, if you would like to send.
Well, yes, of course. Well, I think, as far as I'm concerned, I'm very pleased to know that they are interested in our history, and I hope they come and visit Bletchley.
And I would say, I hope we never have another war again.
Well, certainly, yes.
And that there will be peace in the world.
Thank you very much.
Anti-aircraft guns went into action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 3 a.m. Pacific wartime this morning. The anti-aircraft guns began barking during a blackout ordered by the 4th Interceptor Command at 2:25 a.m. The unidentified object, which some sources thought might be a blimp, moved slowly down the Pacific coast from Santa Monica and disappeared south of Long Beach. Army officials declined to comment on the possibility that the object might have been a blimp.
There was a ramping up of activity to intercept and disseminate as much information as hands could be got upon back here at Bletchley Park. Tell us about the impact it had on the operation here.
Well, the expansion of the Japanese activity here runs kind of in parallel with an expansion of activity against the Germans and the Italians as well, because we've talked previously in the podcast about the Action This Day letter, as it's called, when codebreakers wrote to Churchill and said, we need more resources, we need more bits and pieces. And that expansion and provision of resources was starting to happen in the spring of 1942. Everybody was still very stretched, but they were able to plan further into the future than they had previously. I mean, they're building buildings not just to accommodate the people they've got now, but they're trying to predict how many people they'll have in a year's time.
It must have been a very difficult thing to try and plan for, because nobody knew which turn it was going to take next. I mean, strategists and people will have had an idea of how things were looking, but really, how could anybody have known what was around any corner at that time? It must have been incredibly difficult.
I also think nobody believes by the Christmas of 1941 that it's going to be over by the next Christmas. You know, people are getting dug in for the long haul at that point. And the establishment of the Japanese training school, for example, is a case where they know this is going to take a long time and it's an investment for the quite distant future, but they still think it's worth doing. And like building the buildings that we're sitting in, they took a fair while to build, but it's not stick up a quick timber hut and crack on with the work. It's planned to be here in another year and the year after that if we need to.
And this comes around the same time as a change in leadership here at Bletchley Park as well.
Yes, it was around that time that Denniston, who had been deputy director, the de facto head of Bletchley, up to that point, moved back to London to run the diplomatic section. And his deputy, Travis, stepped up to run GCNCS at Bletchley Park. And he was very instrumental in the upscaling and the industrialisation, if you like, of the process. Denniston was more of a people person, if you like, and he was very involved in nurturing some of the early codebreakers and really coming up with the theoretical ideas. I mean, he was involved with Knox and with Turing and with the breakthroughs that allowed these codes to be read in the first place. After 1942, life has changed a little bit in the sense that those techniques are now, in many cases, established, and they're now working on how do you exploit that?
How do you industrialise that?
How do you industrialise it? How do you now read thousands of those messages? And that's where Travis and Gordon Welshman come in at that point.
No matter how long it may take us, to overcome this premeditated invasion. The American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
We like to talk about how well kept the secret of what was achieved here at Bletchley Park was for 30 years at least after the war, and it was. So it was a big shock when it started to come out in the mid-70s. But I'm not sure how much that was broken down. Did people talk about the Japanese code-breaking? Did they talk about German and Italian code-breaking? Was it really the whole thing? And did people get a sense of how big that operation had been in terms of Japanese code-breaking in the latter part of the war?
They didn't really. I mean, when the story broke in the 1970s, it was quite specifically the story of Enigma and of German interception and the work at Bletchley Park itself. And in a way, people thought they knew the story of Japanese code-breaking because the Americans had declassified a lot of the work they'd done very quickly after the war. So people knew about the likes of William Friedman and all the work the Americans had done on the, by that point, quite famous Japanese codes, JN-25, which is the naval code, Purple, which was the diplomatic code. And the story was well enough known for a raft of myths and controversies to grow up because of all sorts of questioning about what the American government knew or could have known about Pearl Harbor before it happened. Obviously, you know, should they have been...
it's like Coventry.
Oh, yeah, it's like Coventry. I mean, you could fill far too much of your life reading the literature on what the Americans knew or didn't know about Pearl Harbor. Thing is, that debate raged for many years with the British not in the picture at all because the British work against the Japanese, most of the documentation wasn't released until the 1990s. So whereas the Americans in 1945 had gone, "Ooh, look, we broke all these codes," the British, in a typical British fashion, had just not said anything. Also, as we've developed the story of Bletchley Park here and our veterans have come forward to talk to us, you become increasingly aware of numbers of people who were Bletchley Park veterans in the sense that they were part of GCNCS and the code-breaking operation, but many of them got straight on ships and sailed out to the Far East. And we have a big pool of veterans who worked in Colombo, in Kilindini, in Mombasa, and were involved in that, particularly in the latter part, 44, 45. There was a huge effort in that direction. So their as yet untold story of the Bletchley Park operation and GCNCS. I mean, even here on site, we have some information about the war against the Japanese, but the proportion of it that's represented in our collections at the moment is quite low. So it's definitely a story to be told.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy. Write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.